From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, we all have people in our family who love to do things with their hands. And even if it's not you, there's someone in your family who this will relate to. This is one of the really neat ideas we've seen on this program in a while. My colleague Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail, always puts together an interesting rundown. But this one, I'm surprised I didn't know this was going on. So as we get Innovation Friday started, I want to ask Matthew Leonard, are you a handsy pro? Are you a handyman?
I'm definitely an analog guy. Yeah, definitely more like you put your hands, you know, put your hands in the, you know, under the bonnet of the car and
so,
kind of do
so
stuff.
So something
with your
breaks
hands,
at your house, you're going to fix it.
Right. So, well, I'll make an attempt at fixing it. It's not to say it's going to succeed. But yeah, definitely the kind of tactile, something very satisfying, I think, is everyone knows anyone who's involved in crafts, in, you know, the craft movement. What we're talking about, and it's not, I'm glad we can still surprise you, Evan, considering how well informed you are. We're going to talk about makerspaces. So makerspaces, when I was trying to kind of, you know, sort of sum them up as a little pithy kind of pitch for the program, I was thinking it's sort of like your backyard garage workshop, you know, where your uncle and your, you know, hang out. It's like a tool shop or school metal wood shop kind of thing. And it also can potentially have sort of a business angle, like a startup. So that's what we're talking about for the first half of Innovation Friday, Makerspaces. And we've got some people to help us talk a bit more about them. They're becoming very popular and they're popping up all over upstate and central New York. With us in the studio here is Dan Schneiderman. Hi, Dan. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
But you're a computer geek, so why are you interested in Makerspaces? That's what I want to know. You're a coding guy, right? RIT graduate.
I am not just a coding guy. I actually have a history of electronics, robotics. I grew up with a grandfather who was an electrical engineer.
Right. Something I think a lot of people in Rochester will relate to, a lot of people who worked in mechanical, you know, electrical engineering, that kind of stuff. And with us from Syracuse, my colleague Ryan Delaney from WRVO. Ryan's with the Innovation Trail reporting team. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for being with us on Innovation Friday.
Always happy to join you guys.
And Ryan's got a report that we'll hear just in just a moment, which is about a couple of new spaces. This was sort of the trigger for talking about it, as well as the stuff that we're going to talk to Daniel about. So, Dan, just really quickly, one of the reasons we got you on and wanted to talk to you is because there's a sort of a makerspace event happening in November, and you just want to do a shout-out and let people know that there's some there's an information meeting tomorrow here in Rochester. You want to give people that information right off the bat?
Yeah, the Rochester Mini Maker Faire, the first event of its type here in Rochester, will be having an open community meeting tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. at the Henrietta Public Library. We'll be giving an overview. We should have a couple makers there, and hopefully we can show up a couple of projects.
Who is this designed for? Tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., who's it designed for?
This is for anyone who's looking for basic information or who makes anything within Rochester. We're talking hackers. We're talking people who create crafts, art, robots, electronics, any of it. We would love to meet them and to let them know about the fair.
Not necessarily for a business, or is this more business-oriented?
This is less business-oriented tomorrow. This is more of a overall information session.
Okay, so if you're an enthusiastic hobbyist, that sounds like a destination you want to be at tomorrow morning. And to give us a bit more context now, Ryan, so tell us, what are we talking about with these makerspaces? Just give us a little bit of an intro, and then we'll hear your report from one of the newest ones to start up in upstate New York.
Well, I think you put it pretty well. It's kind of like that backyard garage, but with probably a lot more tools than most people have in the back of their garage. It's a community workshop, a community space for people to come and be able to use all sorts of kind of tools, at least the one that I visited, you know, tools that most people aren't going to have, but, you know, maybe people have always wanted to work with wood but don't have that huge table saw. Makerspace is a place for them to be able to come and use one, be able to take a class to learn how to do more with woodworking, or, you know, collaborate work, speak with other people who, you know, do this kind of thing as well. So it's a mix of a resource of not only equipment but also people.
People and ideas and plans and projects, I guess, as well. So let's have a listen to Ryan's report. This is for the Innovation Trail file just this week, and we'll listen to that now.
All right, here we are. Salt Maker Space Clean. Michael Genitasio is a sculptor and metalworker by trade, but he knows his way around a 3D printer too, like the one set up here in the clean space of an old Syracuse factory building. Genitasio is getting ready to open Syracuse's first makerspace in the Delavan Art Building on the city's near west side. It'll be called the SALT Makerspace, short for Syracuse Arts, Learning, and Technology. Along with the clean space, there's what Genitasio calls the dirty space for welding or cutting. Makerspaces are a community-accessible workshop for nearly any kind of art or project that results in a physical product. There are a growing trend in arts communities, and more are opening in upstate New York. Genitasio says he's trying to design a workshop with its own unique feel compared to other makerspaces.
So a lot of the different communities have their own kind of style and flair to them. There's everything from just a room in a building that is just computers to a building that is full of equipment and going to a place that does robotics.
Genitasio has been searching classified ads, taking donations, and raiding stockpiles of old industrial equipment to find tools and machines to fill the space. He says makerspaces aren't just for the artist or professional, but anyone with an interest in tinkering around.
What this place has the potential to be is that resource for someone who has an idea to develop it, whether that's a product or if it's an art project. They would be able to come here, learn how to do it on their own, get instruction, or collaborate with someone to develop something.
That collaboration is a big part of the makerspace experience.
Hang out for a little bit. You guys can feel free to like wander around and look at everything.
At a recent meetup at the space, a diverse group of people show up. Some were curious recent college grads, others engineers with decades of experience. They'll likely end up being both instructors and students here. The makerspace will offer classes on various art techniques and skills, or users can pay a fee and come in and use the equipment.
That whole community really is about opening it up and connecting with one another and giving access to knowledge as well as equipment.
Makerspaces have been popping up in communities across the country for a decade or so. There are ones already in Rochester, Binghamton, and Ithaca. Amanda Sharpstein is a graphic designer. She's working to get a makerspace open in Cortland called the Steam House. She says creating something is one of the best feelings in the world.
But the feeling you get when you actually make something with your own hands is phenomenal, especially with kids and teens or people just entering the workforce, having a skill that can actually create something.
Sharpstein encourages younger kids to play with Legos to give them a feel of actual building and go from there.
And yeah, kids nowadays are learning how to do 3D modeling in school. But unless they're going to be, you know, a mechanical engineer or something, they're really not going to use it. But being able to actually make something with it is really great.
The makerspace in Syracuse will open in mid-September. Genitasio says its success will be measured as people's ideas become tangible objects.
And Ryan Delaney from WRVO reporting there. And Ryan, what about the sort of the kind of the sustainability, the sort of economic base of these? So it uses essentially a kind of membership model for the makerspace?
Mm-hmm. Genitasio is hoping to sustain this by two different ways. Classes being the first one. If someone, you know, an engineer or a sculptor wants to come in and teach a specific class, they can, and the space will get a cut of the registration fee for those classes, or people can pay for a 1-2-day pass or a monthly membership, and then, you know, once they are trained on the safety of using table saws and welders and things like that, they'll be able to just come in and use them on their whenever they want.
Right, sure. And I think I know there's models like the Genesee Art Center here in Rochester City, which is a similar model. I know where people run, you know, photography workshops or, you know, printing workshops and so on to kind of make it self-sustaining. But so what about just sort of looking at some of the more serious literature around makerspaces? Did you sort of see any or, you know, discuss any connections? We heard a little bit about that in the interview you did in Cortland, just about connecting kids to like STEM, you know, an interest in science and engineering, those kinds of things that, you know, which is a big topic that we've discussed.
Yeah, I certainly had to smile when Amanda mentioned using Legos and playing with Legos as a kid, because, you know, me and my older brother, that was everything that we played with, Legos and Kinects and things like that. And, you know, obviously I don't know exactly what 5 and 6 year olds are playing with every day now, but as iPads and more digital things are out there for them to play with, part of this movement is making sure that kids are still using their hands and playing with their hands. And Amanda Sharpstein says that even if, you know, these kids don't necessarily become engineers or sculptors when they grow up, still just having that knowledge, having that base of building things, knowing what it's like to put things together is really important, and it translates into more math and engineering than, you know, you might think of on the surface. It really is building a lot more of that foundation.
I can tell you with a 2.5-year-old, not a 6-year-old, they still have Legos and building blocks, et cetera, and he loves the tactile things like that. But from what we're seeing with friends who have kids, there's so many more competing interests. And you mentioned, again, tablets and all those other things that can kind of get kids away from that hands-on experience. So that's why I think makerspaces do have such a practical application for sort of helping ensure and sow the seeds for future interest. Before we get to a guest from Ithaca, I want to ask Dan real briefly. You were at the Rochester Makerspace just last night, right?
Just last night.
Give us a visual, a quick walkthrough mentally so we can sort of envision what the Rochester space looks like.
It is huge. It is about like 4,000 square feet. They have a separate wood shop. And then their big main room is filled with a 3D printer, filled with soldering irons and different electrical equipment, an area for Legos. They had somebody working on a train set there from scratch. They had a whole set of computers. They were going to teach a programming class there last night. Just tools everywhere.
Very interesting.
And we have to say that Dan did his best efforts to get some folks from the Rochester Makerspace here, but they're all too busy tinkering or doing whatever. So just a shout out to our friends from the Rochester Makerspace. We'd definitely like to get you on the show some stage in the future and talk a bit more about this. And just be thankful that Dan's here flying the flag for you. And or give us a ring at some stage. That would be terrific. So this is a big space on St. Paul's, I believe, right? The Rochester Makerspace?
Yes.
Right, sure. So I think, Evan, you mentioned too, and some of the other stuff I've been reading, we've been hearing a lot about the kind of loss of basic sort of manual ability of people, stuff that people used to be able to do, fix lawnmowers, kind of build a fence, do house repairs, do plumbing at home, all that sort of stuff. We've definitely seen a lot of coverage about the sort of loss of skill in the wake of, the move to computers and that kind of stuff. But Dan, you seem like an interesting and well-adjusted mixture of the two. Between those two things, let's talk to Xanthi Maticek. Xanthi's joining us from the Ithaca Generator, which is one of the makerspaces that Ryan referred to. It's already up and running. Xanthi, thanks very much for dialing into Innovation Friday.
Thank you, Matthew, for having me.
So tell us about the Ithaca Generator. How long has it been running, and what's the kind of the philosophy underpinning it?
Sure. So the Ithaca Generator Makerspace opened up in January of 2013, and we are passionate. We're in the heart of downtown Ithaca, and we're passionate about public access to tools for manufacturing.
Yep.
And making those tools and teaching people those technologies, because we believe, and we also think that the White House believes, the White House just had their first Maker Faire this past June.
Right.
And I think they recognize that innovation can happen anywhere. You don't have to be affiliated with a university or with a well-known engineering firm. That it can happen in garages, and if people in cities, no matter their affiliation, have access to these tools, then they can be inventing tomorrow's next big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I'm interested as a woman involved in the design field as well. I assume you're also trying to engage a lot with young girls and women to bring them into the space as well. That's a big ongoing part of the conversation that the White House has started as well.
Yeah, we do. One of our board members, Jen Colt, said in a recent blog post that we wrote that we're not going to solve the problems of tomorrow if we have half the population believing that they're not good enough, that they don't have the skills to participate. So we've invested heavily in encouraging women to get their hands on microcontrollers and 3D printers and laser cutters to tap into their innovation and creativity.
Yeah. What are some of the projects you've had in the year and a half that you've been running? Just give us a couple of highlights, the things that that struck your fancy.
What has been amazing has been the partnerships that we've had. We're in a town with Cornell University and Ithaca College, and we've done some partnering educational outreach with researchers up at Cornell and the X-Rays Lab for Science Outreach. And recently, we have a great partnership beginning with the public library, which is co-located to us downtown Ithaca. And talk about getting, you know, just people off the street getting their hands into this technology. It's been really amazing.
Can I jump in and just ask real briefly, Xanthia? We have a question on Twitter from Val who says, it's still not quite clear to me who the maker spaces are intended for. I think that's part of the point, is they're kind of intended for everybody. But how do you answer that question, and give me a kind of a cross-section of what you see at the Ithaca Generator?
Yeah, well, if they are for everybody, it's hard getting people into this space. But I'll tell you, we've had kids from... they're four kids and adults, but we've had kids in the public school who have great robotics programs in their public schools, but don't, for socially some reason, don't feel comfortable joining the robotics club in their school, but they do feel comfortable in this more, you know, centralized downtown community workshop space. It really is for everyone. I know that it's intimidating. Let me say that my background is in art. I don't consider myself a technologist, even though I love technology. And over this past year, the members of the Ithaca Generator have kind of taken me in and, you know, have taught me piece by piece how to get comfortable with, you know, getting something to light up, to program LEDs. And those are baby steps towards, you know, making a product that actually has legs.
Dan, you wanted to make a point here.
Yeah, speaking of kids, and as you mentioned libraries, rumor has it is that a bunch of the Monroe County libraries are looking at having mini makerspaces within each library.
Right. So, I mean, that's a really interesting thing. I mean, I'm wondering too, Xanthi, about, you know, we're hearing a lot. I know in country I come from, Australia, they had they had a thing called the Men's Shed. It was the Men's Shed movement, and it was kind of a way of dealing, also of addressing some bigger issues like depression amongst the male population. I'm thinking that people with, you know, huge skill sets like veterans would have a real role to play, I think. Retired people with specialist skills, ex-school teachers, all that kind of stuff would also have a role, you know, within the makerspace dynamic as well.
Definitely. We have so much potential in our community. We're dying to tap into all of those people who have, you know, skills and knowledge to share. We do think that the retired community, there's probably some great retired engineers and tinkerers in Ithaca that we would love to have come down to the makerspace and participate in any way that they want to.
Ryan, just before I let you go, just kind of looking at the links between business, I mean, it is also a place where there are kind of business enterprises are kind of tooling up as well. Is that something that you've been, you know, reading about as well?
Is that a question for Ryan?
Yeah. I was just this is our reporter, Ryan, in Syracuse. I saw, you know, when I was doing some reading and background reading on makerspaces, there was definitely, you know, there was definitely another aspect with it, which was that people could see it as an incubator for startup business or, computer programming ideas, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's something that Michael mentioned as well, as a hope of, you know, maybe two people who have an idea for a product, who might not know each other yet, maybe they can meet at the Makerspace or work on together at the Makerspace, coming up with some sort of prototype or something, be that, you know, something that requires 3D modeling and printing, or, you know, building it in a workshop or a metal shop. So there's certainly that aspect of it as well. It's certainly different than, you know, a tech startup incubator in terms of business space, but that collaboration is certainly a big part of these.
And Xanthi, is that a nice outcome, or is that a part of what you want the generator to do in Ithaca? You know, are you hoping to see some sort of business enterprises coming out of it?
We already have three of our board members have businesses that were either born out of the generator or closely in line with the generator. Wicked Device, that makes microcontrollers in Ithaca, and Boxy Bikes makes electric bikes, who started in the Ithaca Generator and now has an electric bike business. And then there's a game design company by Mark Zipchak, who is our board president. And that's wonderful. I really want to see some women-owned and started businesses coming out of there as well. And it's not our mission, but it can happen. And this is the place where it can happen. If you have an idea and you want to figure out how to make it, never before did people have, you know, access to these cheap, easy-to-use manufacturing tools.
I can see some really interesting discussions around profit sharing coming out of collaborative collaborative spaces where people say, well, hell, I put in 3 nights on that thing, you know, the patent discussion. But no, seriously, I mean, just in terms of managing the politics and the, you know, a kind of democratic open space, I mean, is that, do you talk a little bit about things like intellectual property rights, that kind of, you know, intellectual rights and so on as part of the process of the generator? Has that
well,
come up at all?
You know, we do, but part of this culture, and these are our members who have started these businesses, and, you know, that would be a great problem to have, quite honestly. We, you know, had so many successful businesses that we didn't know how to handle it.
Yeah. Great. That's Xanthi Matuszek. Xanthi, thanks very much for dialing in from the Ithaca Generator. We're going to stay with Makerspaces just a little bit longer. Evan, you got more stuff coming in on Twitter there?
I do, and a lot of people are just asking sort of I think they're like me. They didn't know these things were available, and people are asking basic questions like, you know, if I tell my brother, if I tell my dad about this, can you just show up one day, Dan, at the Rochester one and get in and use the space, or do you need to sort of apply for it or that kind
of
thing?
You can just show up. I walked in last night, and I saw they were actually having a tour around the place. Last night was their open community evening. Some evenings they have classes, so sometimes it's good to look ahead. But for most of the makerspaces I've seen and gone to, you could just show up, walk in, and everyone's really friendly.
So folks, you know, we'll put some links up on the Innovation Trail and on the Connections website. Just search for Rochester Makerspace, and there's also the information session. I'm sure you can connect tomorrow to Henrietta Public Library at 10 o'clock. There'll be other ways to connect to that, but it does seem like an open forum. Ryan, that's your understanding with the other makerspace, like the Syracuse space. It's definitely a kind of open-door policy pretty much, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. The Salt Makerspace here has their meetups on Thursday evenings. I don't know if that's weekly, but September 11th, so middle of September, is their grand opening formally.
Great.
And yeah, people are certainly welcome to just pop on in.
Great. We'll let you go. Thanks very much. That's Ryan Delaney from WRVO and the Innovation Trail.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks very much. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, my pleasure, guys. Have a good afternoon.
Dan, I guess just the place of the fair. So we're just to talk a bit about the Mini Maker Fair. What sort of goes on at those events? What's their kind of role? Are they just really a showcase, or are they a prize winning thing?
It's a mix of things. It's a really hard event to describe because while there is a lot of booths that you can go and see projects and learn basic things, there's also tutorials where we're setting up a soldering workshop where you can make little electronic badges. I believe there's going to be a couple of people there with kits. There's going to be demonstrations. You're going to be able to interact with a lot of things. We will have two large sculptures, one balloon, one toothpick, at the fair.
So the venue for the fair that's on in November. So this is November 22nd we're talking for the
yes.
Mini Maker Fair. What's the venue?
The Rochester Riverside Convention Center.
So it's a big space, so it sounds like you're going to need the room. the people are going to be able to prepare projects that they can display there. There's going to be resources and information about kits, other resources for makers and the maker movement.
Yes. In fact, we invite all makers to apply. We're hoping to get at least 75 different makers there. We only have about 20 so far. But we want to get as many people there showing off as much of their work from all over New York.
But again, that sounds a little – it doesn't sound exclusive, but it sounds like you said you want makers to show up. Can you be a self-defined maker, or is there a certain level of makingness that you need to achieve?
You can be a self-defined maker.
Okay. So there's no level of technical expertise or achievement or business achievement?
No.
Scalable creation, that kind of thing.
All levels. We want art. We want crafts. I believe we have a wool group coming in, and I think a couple different art groups already. We want to make it as balanced as possible between art, technology. We want to get everyone.
So is it I'm just interested about whether it's kind of a – because when I looked at it, it seemed like Popular Mechanics magazine from the 1950s, you know, it just sort of seemed like the stuff that you know, elderly male relatives of mine used to do back in the day when they had fantastic grandfather's tool shop and they were doing that stuff. Seemed to have a very much a kind, almost not exactly a Luddite kind of feeling to it, but very much a kind of, you know, just back to basics – you know, skills, skill sets, tools, and that kind of stuff. So, but you're saying it's also there's also the space for programming, computer generated design, etc.
It's a mix. It's a complete mix. We're reaching out to guilds, which I honestly never knew that there were different guilds around Rochester. And we're reaching out to people who build robots. We love to see that mix. And I think a couple groups even mix the two between art and technology.
Right. So, Dan, for more information, folks, sounds like they want to get to the Henrietta Public Library tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And, Dan, who else is kind of organized? Who else is interested in the Maker Faire?
Well, we've been we are working with NYSCATE, the New York State Association for Computers and Technology in Education. We've been talking with RIT, MCC, the Rochester Museum and Science Center. We're talking to a lot of different people.
Because I think the Rochester Museum and Science Center have a kind of makerspace for kids already that's been up and running for a while now, doing similar kinds of things. So, just finally, so the fair, you have to kind of charge people to be able to. How do you kind of make the economics of the fair work?
Well, we are looking for sponsors as our main way to pay for the event, but we're also tickets are $5 right now for early bird.
Yep. Okay.
And then we have family price tickets.
Okay, cool. So you've got a website up for the Maker Faire already?
Yep, makerfairerochester.com.
Makerfairerochester.com. All right. And just for people who want to check out the Rochester Makerspace, just look for Rochester Makerspace in your friendly search engine.
I think this is fascinating stuff. Dan, great stuff. Thanks for sharing more about it. And again, I'm thinking of my father-in-law and so many people in our lives who are going to say, had no idea it was there. So I'm sure that's the reaction you get from a lot of people. So.
Yes, it is.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and then Matthew Leonard, what's next?
We're going to develop a really interesting connection with some colleagues at WGBH in Boston. They're also... tilling the field of innovation, a great blog and broadcasting project called Innovation Hub. We're going to be joined by our colleague Kara Miller, who's the host and executive editor of Innovation Hub, and we're going to hear what they've been reporting on over in Boston. And that's coming up after the break.
All right, let's take the shortest break in radio and right back with Innovation Friday. Coming up in our second hour of Innovation Friday, kids in the city, at-risk children, often have great ideas but not a lot of support to follow through. A new program seeks to change that by pairing them up with mentors in the business community. And then, if you could see how your energy costs were shaping up every day, every hour, would it change it? We're talking about innovation in the energy sector next hour.
Katie Simpson Smith read between the lines of historical documents to write her Revolutionary War novel.
Feeling my way around these white people's words in order to get at what an enslaved woman's life might have been like was challenging, but I feel like that experience needs to be represented more in fiction.
Writing the South of the 1700s, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and it's Innovation Friday. The editor of the Innovation Trail is Matthew Leonard. He's with me in studio as he works through a packed show today. What's going on now, Matthew?
So glad to be joined by another innovative reporting project called the Innovation Hub. This is a project that's operating at WGBH in Boston. And hopefully on the end of some technology is the host and executive editor of Innovation Hub, Kara Miller. Kara, welcome to Innovation Friday.
Hey, glad to be with you.
Wow, it's just like you're in the room.
You're not supposed to give it away, Matthew.
That's what we aim for with this crafty technology.
I know. See, Matthew gave the game away here, but okay.
We could have maintained the illusion the whole time. Hey, great to talk to you, and also just congratulations on the work that your team's doing there. Interesting connection. I mean, obviously, the innovation economy is a kind of a really dense brief for anyone to tackle. So tell us a little bit about just how you guys are approaching, you know, the innovation economy and the ideas of innovation in the work that you're doing.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a funny thing. We started the show almost 3 years ago now. And it was really just an effort to look at innovation and all sorts of things. Because very often I think tech coverage is like, wow, the newest iPhone is 5 millimeters thinner. Can you believe it? You know, that kind of thing. And we wanted to look at, okay, well, that's great. But how do you change schools? And how do you change hospitals? And how do you change, you know, our healthcare situation, and how do you fix transportation? So, for example, you know, if we had high-speed rail, as many other countries do, I'd be able to get to New York in like an hour and a half, you know, on the train. And so we started talking about, okay, why isn't that happening? How could it happen? That kind of thing. And it has taken off as a podcast. We started at like 7 a.m. on Saturdays here in Boston. And you know, as the show went along, one day somebody who was helping us do some stuff said, like, you have more followers on SoundCloud than Katy Perry, which right. I don't really – I mean, take that for whatever it's worth. I'm not sure what it's worth.
I believe
exactly.
I totally believe that, actually.
And I think people are just interested in innovation and bringing innovation to different areas. So that's kind of – that's what we try to do.
Right, absolutely. Well, I think definitely we've also – I think – realize that people are interested in innovation in things like innovation in public policy, innovation in
right.
local governance, innovation
That's right.
in how budgets are organized, that kind of stuff, rather than, as you're saying, this sort of tendency to immediately associate it with technology. So let's go to some of the coverage that you've been doing, and we've got some sound that you guys have shared with us, and we'll share with our audience. So back to school season, tell us what you've been thinking, how you've been approaching the whole kind of back to school thing and the debates within education.
So, you know, we have sort of tried to take on recently in our reporting this question of, okay, how do you fix schools? We've been talking about it forever. I mean, you could go back to the Reagan administration and A Nation at Risk and this idea that we were falling behind globally. And now, of course, we have a much more interconnected world and there's a lot more question about global competition. And so, you know, the question is, all right, what's next in education? And one of the people sort of on the forefront of what's next is Sal Khan. I don't know if you guys, do you guys know Khan Academy?
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah. And a lot of people who have kids in school are going to know it. I think it's being used in like 25,000 classrooms around the country. And basically it's this guy, Sal Khan, and he started doing these little modules actually to help his cousin in New Orleans. And it was sort of like, okay, here's 10 minutes on variables in algebra. Here's 10 minutes on art history, you know, maybe some part that you're having trouble with. And people started watching this stuff on YouTube. Lessons have now been listened to more than 400 million times. Bill Gates' kids use it. So I talked to him about, okay, you know, what's next? And he said this interesting thing, which is that what's next in his mind is the customization of education. Because the way education works now is, you know, there'll be a lesson on algebra or whatever. And some kids kind of get it and some kids kind of don't. But it doesn't really matter because at the end, the teacher sort of has to move on to the next thing. And so you have people working at different paces, but they are all doing the same thing regardless of where they are. And so he said, one thing that's really important to do is to customize. And I think we have a little tape of him talking about this.
Here we go.
The reality is a lot of what I'm saying isn't new at all. 300 years ago, if you asked someone what's the best way to teach someone, they would have said, well, teach it at their pace, make sure they master concepts. This is what the tutors would have done for the lords and the princes and whatever else. The problem before kind of our current age was when they tried to do this, every student had to learn at their own pace. Every student had different gaps. It was a logistical nightmare. It was, you know, the teacher couldn't keep track of all of that information. Well, that's what technology is good at. It's good at coordinating information, and it frees up the human being to do the human interventions. Looking at the data, oh, look, Susan is still having trouble with this concept. Billy has mastered that, ready for this next concept. And if someone's struggling, the teacher can intervene, or they can start pairing up students and let them work on a kind of a peer-to-peer basis.
So, I mean, you sort of have the idea of maybe we're all in a classroom together, but maybe we can all do what's right for us at the moment that's right for us. And the idea is the flipped classroom.
And let me also remind our listeners that earlier this year when we talked about the new SAT tests and the way the College Board is making some changes, some controversial, Sal Khan has been a huge part of that, because the complaint about SATs for so long is that if you can afford to get good tutoring and good prep, your
right.
kids are going to have a better outcome. Sal Khan wants to put together the kind of the most effective SAT prep online, the same kind of model he's been using for Khan Academy, for free. And essentially he's saying it's not just going to be the free option if you can't afford it. It's going to be the best possible option for tutoring kids, getting them ready for the SAT. So his model has been remarkably successful. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, and it'll be really interesting to see sort of what happens with this idea of, you know, you're talking about with the SATs of basically you can be at home, you know, 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night,
yep,
and you can learn something. You can learn something about variables in algebra. You can learn something about the Vietnam War. And so when you then go into class, when you have a session with somebody else, what you do is not listen to them lecture. I mean, Sal Khan is very sort of very adamant about the fact that lecturing is not the best way to transmit information, where one person just stands up there and everybody sort of passively listens. That the best thing to do is listen to those lectures in your own time and then come into school and do a project with the people in class or do your homework in school and then have the teacher come over when you say, but I don't understand how to do this problem.
So Anifin raised the issue around the SATs and testing, which I think is your next point that you wanted to move on to, Kara. This just the, yeah, whole kind of role of the common, you know, the highly controversial Common Core in testing.
Yeah, this is a really interesting question of whether we should have more tests, fewer tests. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people over the years, and there's a real divided view of this. You know, one of the people I talked to recently was Amanda Ripley, who wrote a book that got a lot of attention recently called The Smartest Kids in the World. And what she basically did is, you know, how those tests come out every few years from the OECD, the PISA test, which basically says, okay, here are industrialized countries and here's how the U.S. ranks in amongst these industrialized countries. And we never tend to do all that well. So Amanda Ripley said, okay, well, how about the countries that are doing well? Finland, for example, South Korea, they routinely get at the very top of these lists. She went there and she tried to figure out what are these places doing right. And one of the things that she comes away with is that testing actually is not bad. You know, a lot of people would say take tests out of schools. And Amanda Ripley's view, testing is actually really important. But she also says, Getting the right tests to students is crucial, and I think we've got a little bit of her talking about that.
Unfortunately, many states have invested in a lot of not very smart tests over the past 10 to 15 years, right? The end result is that we've created this kind of anti-testing backlash, which is totally understandable, and I hear this a lot from kids. And it sort of chips away at the credibility of the whole system when we're spending so many days either preparing for or responding to stupid bubble tests. At the same time, all over the world, countries that have some kind of standardized testing tend to be more equitable, fair places with stronger education systems. The trick is the quality of the test.
That's sorry. I'm just for people who came in late. Amanda Ripley, who's the author of The Smartest Kids in the World, and also just to mention that for people who may have just joined us, Kara Miller is with us on the line from Boston. Kara is the host and executive editor of Innovation Hub, not Innovation Trail. It's more a hub. They do more of a hub over there. It is Boston, which is awesome. And we're sharing some of the reporting that they've been doing, particularly at the moment in the area of education, workforce preparation, and topics like that. Sorry, I cut you off there, Kara. But yeah, you're going to come in on the end of Amanda's point about the testing regimes.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting thing. And she really does make this distinction between like dumb tests and smart tests and really feels that they're not all created equal. She actually points to Poland, which basically did almost what we're doing with Common Core. And over the last several years, they developed a Common Core. And she says they have shot ahead in these international tests. They used to be not very good, lagging behind the United States. Now they rank much higher than the United States in math, science, and reading. So, you know, she feels like having this kind of standard is something important, which is interesting and a controversial point.
Okay. And so a lot of the anxiety or a lot of what's driving this is obviously about things like international competitiveness of the American workforce. And, you know, this is a topic that we've, you know, frankly droned on about in the innovation trail for 3.5 years, really about the mismatch between the skill sets that are coming out of schools and the things like the manufacturing environment, you know, particularly with the legacy cities of upstate, you know, in Western New York and Ohio, in the Midwest, where, you know, there was a real kind of path into manufacturing, and that's sort of changed. So how much is that seems to be sort of driving, you know, is driving the debate around testing and what's happening within the job, you know, the jobs that are available?
Oh, I think it's driving it a lot. I mean, you see yourself, everybody sort of has had this experience where over the last few years, we could even expand it out to 10 or 15 years, they've seen jobs disappear. So, for example, when I was a kid, I remember going to bank tellers with my mom.
Right.
Well, there are almost no bank tellers anymore, right, because everybody goes to ATMs. There's a few bank tellers, but not nearly on the scale that there used to be. I remember checking in at the airport with a person. I don't usually do that anymore. I check in at a kiosk with a not person. you know, I remember, and this is does not remembering very far back, when every single line at the grocery store or at the drugstore was staffed by a person, right? But now you go to the grocery store and the drugstore, and increasingly, I don't know if it's happening, if you see it around you, but I see around me a lot of those lines being turned into self-checkout, which is basically saying, well, you know, robotic or computers are robotic assistance is going to check you out.
Right.
No. Do
no.
You see that?
Yeah. No.
Also,
absolutely. Yeah. And I think that I've seen some pretty good stand-up comedy actually done about the whole idea of going there and you know being turned into your own packer at the supermarket and so on.
right.
So what about the argument around the fact that you know that all technology is bad and then it's really just driving down you know kind of the ability for human to make a you know make a reasonable and fair living.
Well, I mean, you know, this is still being hashed out and is going to be for a long time. Let me give you the sort of negative argument first, and then I'll talk a little bit about the potential upside of things. So, you know, the sort of source material on this is these two guys at MIT, Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, who have made this argument. Their first book was called Race Against the Machine, which pretty much is what it says. It's like humans racing against machines. And they felt like, in large part, machines are winning. So I talked to Eric Brynjolfsson, then you'll hear Andrew McAfee talking about this idea of, yeah, tech takes jobs away. I think we have a little bit of it.
For 200 years, it was a rising tide. The pie got bigger and everybody got better off. But over the past about 15, 20 years, those trends have diverged. Productivity continues to grow strongly. Wealth is growing strongly. Innovation, I think, has never been faster. But median income has fallen. And part of that is because these same technologies that create wealth, they also automate a lot of tasks, especially routine information processing tasks. Take tax preparation. There are hundreds of thousands of tax preparers, many of them with college educations, working at places like H&R Block. But a few years ago, people developed TurboTax. TurboTax has taken the steps of tax preparation, codified it, put it into an algorithm, and then those steps can now be copied onto a disk. And when they do that, they do create enormous wealth. It's faster, easier, more accurate, cheaper, and more people are switching to doing that for $39. But if you're one of those 100,000 tax preparers, several hundred thousand, your job's in jeopardy. And in fact, many of those jobs have disappeared. There's a lot fewer of them now, about 20% fewer of them now than there were a few years ago. So simultaneously, the digital technology is growing the pie, but redistributing it.
Technology is now demonstrating these skills and abilities that used to belong to human beings alone. The historical pattern of technology creating at least as many jobs as it destroys, that pattern is not giving me a huge amount of confidence these days because I have, when I call up different airlines, I deal entirely with technology and I get my reservation done. I can talk to my phone. Eric and I rode in a car that had no driver a while back. I see these examples keep adding up. I don't know where the new opportunities are going to be that are going to have a huge thirst for labor. That could just be my short-sightedness, but I don't see them.
Okay, so I'll give that was a little bit of a, you know, gloomy assessment, but I will say the other side of this is, you know, 70 years ago, if you had told somebody, yeah, I'm going to be a web developer, they would have no idea what you were talking about. So I think very often the things that are going to be created, we have a very hard time seeing right at the moment before those jobs ever exist.
Right. So, yep. Routine work disappears, then there's this kind of search on for meaning, you know, meaningful employment, meaning through whatever it is that people do, and that presents its own kind of challenges of establishing meaning through employment.
Well, and we had James Barrett on this program last month, the author of Our Final Invention, who not only says technology is going to take more jobs than it gives, but it could, after the singularity, eventually wipe out the human race. That's pretty dark. That's pretty
negative. That's a rough way of seeing things. I do think that this certainly does. We've been talking about these sort of rote routine. Like if you can codify what you do with like a 10 step or an 8 step, you know, saying like this is what I do, that's going to be replaced probably by a computer. So we do have to get to a point where what people do is the creative stuff, because you know right now that is very hard for a computer to do, whereas it's very easy for a computer or a robot to put, you know, the tube of toothpaste and the cap on the tube of toothpaste. Like that just gets done over and over and over again. And once the computer or the robot learns how to do it, it just keeps doing it. And it's going to be a lot faster than you. It's never going to need to take a break, and it's not going to go to sleep. So you have to, you know, be good at the creative things that are kind of subjective and, yeah.
Right, and I understand too. You've got some sound from someone who suggests that actually one of the things to encourage creativity is many people won't be surprised to hear it's just to stay out of the office environment. Do you want to just set up this little bit of tape?
I talked to Jason Fried, really interesting guy. He's a CEO of a company, a web application company called Basecamp. A lot of people use Basecamp in their offices, so they know that software. And he basically said, look, we're entering this new era where if you have really creative workers and what the premium is on is creativity, you have to treat them differently than we treated workers 50 or 70 or 100 years ago. You don't structure the same kind of environment if you're not having people, you know, push buttons and put widgets together. And so one of the things he says is interrupting creative people who are deep into writing code or deep into writing an article or thinking about something in a creative way, that is evil. Don't do that. So here's a little bit of him talking.
You know, it's like if you're sleeping and somebody just calls your name or bumps into you or something, you wake up and now you don't just get right back to sleep, you have to fall back to sleep. So it's quite a big distraction. I think that the same thing is true for work, that if somebody calls your name or taps you on the shoulder or just shows up at your desk, you know, you were probably doing something important and now you're not because your attention has shifted. Communicating virtually helps to prevent that because you can kind of close a window or put something aside while you're working rather than having a physical interruption, which is what happens in most offices.
I mean, how many people have you heard complain that their day is entirely taken up by meetings?
I couldn't agree more, and we joke around here that we have meetings about meetings, and by the way, we say that with love for WXXL.
Right. At the end of this meeting, we'll decide whether or not we take this. It rises to the level of another meeting.
All right, Carr, can I rush you? Because I want to get to your next cut.
Sure.
It's almost a minute long, and we're going to run out of time. Gambling, a big issue here in New York. We're going to see casino expansion around New York State with at least 4 new state-sanctioned casinos. You talked to Natasha Dow Scholl from MIT, who says that the way that the slot machines seem to suck you in is not an accident, right?
Right, exactly. It's this finely tuned system. She has done some of the really interesting research on this. And let's listen to how she talks about slot machines being fabricated now.
It can take up to 350 individuals who are involved in the design of any one new game. And it's everything from ergonomic specialists who actually design the chair that will accompany a particular slot machine, to the console, to the sound engineers who, in one company, the design team only played the sounds in the key of C. And the idea was that this would be kind of this universally pleasant key to have all the sounds play in. There are choices made about the visuals. And then the most important thing is the math. And by math, what's meant there is really the game algorithms inside. And there, yes, you have the math PhDs who are often running what's called math farms, where they're simulating how well these different game algorithms work for different audiences.
And a couple important things to keep in mind here. One is people may think that it's the other games besides slots where the real money is in the casino. Not so. 75, 80, 85% of casinos' revenues come from slots.
Wow.
And the second thing is these algorithms are really, really powerful, and they know how to suck you in.
And I guess that's, you know, obviously one of the reasons why it's the whole issue around casinos and so on is so contentious and so sort of volatile when it's put in the context as it's being done in New York State around economic, economic development is really the way that it's being framed in the political world.
Yes, here too.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. We're out of time. It's been great to talk to you. Kara Miller is the host and executive editor of the Innovation Hub. Check out their blog and their podcasts. Go to blogs.wgbh.org, Innovation Hub. I'm sure if you just Google Innovation Hub.
Yeah, or innovationhub.org works.
Innovationhub.org.
Thank you so much for having me.
Even better. Yeah. It's been great to catch up with you. And let's do this again in September if you're up for it.
Sounds good.
All right, terrific. That's Kara Miller. Thanks, on the line from Boston.
A lot of great information there, Matthew.
Yeah, absolutely. Great way to pack in a lot of meaty stuff.
All right.
In 25 minutes.
All right, so you've seen just the peripatetic pace of the innovation trail here and the peripatetic nature of it. We hit a lot of places and subjects, and we move on, and we're headed for the second hour next. I'm Evan Dawson. Matthew Leonard is the editor of the Innovation Trail. It's Innovation Friday right here on Connections. Stay with us.